Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Susan Shand, Dorothy Gundy, Anne Ball, and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Susan Shand.
Officials know there will be problems when the United States Census Bureau starts counting people next year in Detroit. The city has tens of thousands of empty houses, poor internet connection, and many poor people. These conditions are expected to make it difficult to get a truthful number. There are other problems for the nationwide count also. People have moved away from many towns in the middle of the country. Cities in the South and Southwest, however, have large numbers of immigrants and new arrivals from other parts of the country. The Associated Press has examined government census information. It has determined that about 25% of the country's population live in areas that are hard to count. This includes a majority of people in cities such as Atlanta, Cleveland, Dallas, Los Angeles, Milwaukee, Memphis, Tennessee, and Fresno, California. Getting a truthful count is very important because the census helps decide where $1.5 trillion in federal money will go. It also decides which states will gain or lose congressional representation. There is nothing more important than reaching the hard-to-count, Census Bureau Director Stephen Dillingham told lawmakers last summer.
In the case of Detroit, the city has started to grow again. The renewal includes improvements to downtown buildings, new hotels, and growing arts neighborhoods. But the Renaissance has done little for some people who live in poverty. Many do not trust officials after years of racial problems. Racial conflict in the 1950s and 1960s was part of the reason that many people left the city. Its population fell from 1.8 million to 670,000. Annette Brock lives northeast of the city's center. She said some people see no connection between answering questions from the government and improving their lives. Everybody else outside of us gets help before we do, Brock said. Nationwide, the Census Bureau predicts that 60.5% of people will answer its questions. About 70% of people who live in Detroit returned their 2000 census forms. That percentage fell to 64% in 2010. When the national rate was 74%. The city loses $2,000 to $5,000 each year for every uncounted person, said Victoria Kovari. She is the director of Detroit's 2020 census campaign.
City census workers have gone to nearly 130,000 homes in neighborhoods that were undercounted in the last census. They have spoken with more than 26,000 people. But Kovari is still concerned. For the first time, the Census Bureau would like citizens to answer questions online. But the agency estimates that 30% of Detroit homes do not have an internet connection. That is twice the national average. The Census Bureau sends workers to homes that do not answer the official form, but often they visit empty homes. Diana Elliott is an Urban Institute researcher who co-wrote a report last summer. The report estimated that from 900,000 to 4 million people could be missed in the national census. Elliott also believes the Black population will be undercounted. Almost 80% of Detroit is African American. Some researchers have learned that Latinos, African Americans, non-English speaking immigrants, and children under 5 years old are the most difficult to count. Other groups that are hard to count include tribal members, non-traditional families, and people with informal living arrangements. Experts say the Trump administration's effort to put a citizenship question on the census form may frighten immigrants who live in the country illegally. The question will not be included in the 2020 census.
California and New Mexico have some of the nation's largest Latino neighborhoods. In those states, over 40% of the population lives in hard-to-count neighborhoods. For census workers, some states are easier to count. Vermont, Maine, and West Virginia have some of the highest numbers of white residents and older people. They are more likely to fill out census forms. There, less than 5% of the population lives in hard-to-count neighborhoods. To make sure people understand the importance of the 2020 census, California is spending an estimated $187 million on advertising and events. It is paying neighborhood leaders to work in their communities. California census officials also are paying experts whose only job is to get to 15 hard-to-count groups, including farm workers, the homeless, and people without the internet. You really have to understand the barriers that exist, said Ditas Kadagyu. He is director of the California Complete Count Census 2020 Office. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
And I'm Susan Shand.
Years ago, Karabiran Parameshwaran and his wife, Chudamani, both considered suicide after their three children died. The three, a son and two daughters, were aged 5, 9, and 12 at the time. They were among the estimated 230,000 victims of a tsunami in the Indian Ocean. On December 26, 2004, a magnitude 9 earthquake struck off the coast of Indonesia. The quake caused huge waves that reached not just Indonesia, but also India and 10 other countries. More than 6,000 people were killed in India's Nagapattinam district, where the Parameshwaran family lived. Days after the storm, the couple walked from their town in southern India to nearby villages. We could see many children standing on the road without shelter, without parents, Chudamani told reporters with the Reuters news agency. I thought, I lost my children. Why don't I take these children and give them shelter? At first, Chudamani and her husband brought 4 orphans home. Soon after, they turned their home into an orphanage. They called it Nambikoi. The name means hope in the Tamil language. Within days, the number of orphans under their care expanded from 4 to 36. The couple had a newfound purpose in life. Karabiran, an executive engineer, and Chudamani, who works for a life insurance company, went on to care for 45 orphans at Nambikai. They set up 2 buildings to house them, one for girls and one for boys. At first, the couple used their own money to pay all the costs, but their friends have also helped. The couple has also had 2 more children of their own.
Many Americans gather together as families and spend time with each other over the winter holidays. It can be difficult when a family member suffers from memory loss. Tim Hollingsworth knows. The well-known American chef learned to cook at his mother's side when he was growing up. Hollingsworth would measure ingredients to help her make dinner. He would talk with his mother and taste the food as they cooked. Today, he is the winner of the Final Table competition on Netflix, the media production company. He also is the owner of Otium, a restaurant in Los Angeles, California. Hollingsworth still cooks with his mother, but it is different now. She struggles with memory loss. She sits with him as he prepares meals from her favorite recipes. These include recipes for comfort foods, ones that fill your stomach and warm your heart with happy memories while filling a home with a pleasant smell. His mother does not cook anymore, but being present at the cooking and eating foods she may remember helps close the distance that dementia can create.
Dementia and Alzheimer's disease affect older people's memories. Over time, patients lose their memories piece by piece. The first to go are usually the newer memories. The older memories from when they were young can be the last to disappear. Being with family and doing things together can help. When we make and share food with others, we feel a sense of usefulness and belonging, says Sheila Maloney. She studies the aging process and is a professor of nursing at Quinnipiac University in Hamden, Connecticut. Family members with dementia can be involved in meal preparation or setting the table. That may give them some sense of peace and what Maloney calls at-homeness. It helps them feel like part of a family or community.
Kim Borghoff and her family kept their tradition of Sunday meals together as her husband and his father were both struggling with Alzheimer's disease at the same time. Both men were found to have Alzheimer's several years ago. That is when she began making sure that every other Sunday, the whole family had dinner together, just like they did when their children were growing up. What they ate was not important. It was instead the familiar and comforting experience of sitting around the table together, even after the family had finished eating. It helped both men regain some of their old personalities, even if just for a short time.
This year, the Alzheimer's Association has been spreading the word about the connecting power of mealtime through their Around the Table program. Along with Hollingsworth, the group asked other chefs to help. They include Hugh Atchison, chef and owner of two restaurants in the state of Georgia. Atchison's father, a former professor, developed Alzheimer's about 5 years ago. Sharing meals was always a part of their relationship. But it is different for Hugh Atchison as his father's memory slowly disappears. His father was a single parent, raising four children alone, while working full-time. Atchison says his father did not have much time to cook complicated meals. Now the son might cook a good steak and simply add a fresh green salad as a side dish.
Atchison says a good meal made with love can bring out a person with dementia and bring them real joy. We make memories over good food that's been cared for, he says. Food that has been made with thought and love. I'm Ann Ball.
And I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In March of 1868, Congress tried to remove President Andrew Johnson from office. But the Senate failed in the effort by one vote. Andrew Johnson was a Democrat. Congress was controlled by radical members of the Republican Party. Most of the charges at Johnson's trial were based on his dismissal of the Secretary of War. A new law said the president could not remove a cabinet officer without Senate approval. Johnson said the law was unconstitutional. The trial was an important turning point in the making of the nation. Removal from office would have established the idea that the president could serve only with the approval of Congress. The president would have become, in effect, a prime minister, requiring the support of Congress to remain in office. Andrew Johnson's victory kept alive the idea of an independent presidency. Although Congress failed to remove him, the vote did not end a conflict with the White House over the future of the South. But it did have an effect on efforts to rebuild the South following the war. Radical Republicans wanted to punish the South for starting the war. They also wanted to be sure new governments in the southern states would support the Republican Party. Doug Johnson and Frank Oliver tell about the Reconstruction of the South.
One way radical Republicans gained support was by helping give blacks the right to vote. They knew former slaves would vote for the party which had freed them. Another way Republicans kept control in the South was by preventing whites from voting there. They passed a law saying no Southerner could vote if he had taken part in the rebellion against the Union. This prevented the majority of Southern whites from voting for Democrats and against Republicans.
Congress also made strong rules about what Southern states had to do to re-enter the Union. It said each of the states needed a new constitution that protected the voting rights of all black men. And it said each Southern state must approve an amendment to the United States Constitution that gave citizenship to blacks. The radicals did not rest with changes in the law. They also sent their supporters south to organize blacks for the Republican Party. Many Southern whites hated these men from the North. They had a special name for them, carpetbaggers. The name arose because many of the Northerners who went south arrived with all their possessions in a carpet handbag. Southerners also had a name for their own people who cooperated with the carpetbaggers. They called them scalawags. Neither name was friendly.
Southern whites had a reason to be bitter. They had lost the Civil War. Now much of their power was gone, and they were suffering. But there was another side to the story as well. Southern whites had held black people in slavery for many years. Now the former slaves were getting to enjoy a small taste of freedom. Also, the South had started the Civil War, which had caused so much death and destruction. It was not surprising that the North showed little sympathy when the fighting stopped and the South lay in ruins. Southern states organized conventions to form new governments. Soon, all but three Southern states had new legislatures. Not surprisingly, radical Republicans held firm control in every one of the new governments. Many of the new governors and state officials were carpetbaggers from outside the state. Others were Southern scalawags.
Many of these new state officials were dishonest. They began using their power to become rich. In South Carolina, for example, the new governor was a former army officer from the state of Ohio. He gave government jobs to many dishonest men, including some who were wanted for crimes in other states. The same situation existed in other state governments in the South. In Louisiana, for example, the governor was a carpetbagger from the state of Illinois. He left office after 4 years with $1 million. His official pay during that time was only $32,000.
The South was not the only place where public officials were dishonest. The period after the Civil War in the United States was marked by several famous incidents involving violations of the public trust. Some of these incidents took place in the North, even in the White House. They were among the worst examples of dishonesty and poor government ever to take place in American history. It also is important to note that not everyone in the South was dishonest. The new state governments did many good things. They built roads and bridges, schools, and hospitals. They improved transportation and education. They loaned money to companies to build railroads. Most important, they helped give hope to former slaves. These people were struggling to create a new life in the land of their former owners.
So the record of Reconstruction in the South was mixed. Many Southerners believe, even today, that Reconstruction was a bitter time of defeat. But others now say this period after the Civil War was a necessary step in creating a different kind of South from the one which had existed before. Historians do agree that Reconstruction changed the United States in several important ways. One of the most important changes was in the Constitution. Congress passed three historic amendments to the Constitution during this period.
The first was the 13th Amendment. It ended slavery in the United States. The next was the 14th Amendment. It said, all persons born or naturalized in the United States were citizens of the United States and of the state in which they lived. It said no state could limit the rights of these citizens. Finally, there was the 15th Amendment. It said, a citizen of the United States could not be prevented from voting because of his color. The 13th Amendment freed all Negro slaves. The 14th and 15th Amendments were supposed to protect their rights. These laws alone, however, did not succeed in doing this. It would take another century until Martin Luther King and other civil rights leaders to make these rights a reality. Yet the passage of these three amendments to the Constitution was still a historic step in making blacks full and equal citizens.
These same laws and other actions of the radical Republicans changed the South in other, less desirable ways. They helped cause angry whites to form the Ku Klux Klan and other groups that terrorized blacks for years to come. The laws also increased bitterness between the North and South that lasted many years. Reconstruction changed the economy of the South, too. White landowners broke up their big farms into smaller pieces of land. They rented these to black farmers. With the land came seed, tools, and enough supplies for a year. In exchange for this, the owner would get a large share of the crop raised by the tenant farmer. This system, called sharecropping, spread through the South. It lasted for almost 100 years. Sharecropping made it possible for blacks to work the land for themselves for the first time in their lives. But it also made it difficult for them to earn enough money to improve their condition. As a result, the majority of Southern blacks remained in poverty. The system helped cause the South to be the poorest part of the United States for many years.
The Reconstruction period changed the face of the South and the United States. The events of Reconstruction also were central to one of the nation's most interesting presidential elections.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.